Today's session will be dealing with practical tips for dream interpretation. So we will be doing some review of the geography that we've been covering, the spiritual geography that we walk together. But my intention this morning is that you can leave here with some tools to deal with your own dreams, as well as those of persons who are your close personal friends and others that you feel it would be appropriate to invite to explore that dimension of their experience. So we're going to begin again by asking a blessing on our time, the sacred ground that we share. And this morning I'm going to suggest that we do that in two ways. There is a movie now starring Jack Nicholson that is out. Some of you, I don't believe any of you have seen it because it's just been released about a week ago, called The Witches of Eastwick. Have any of you read the book? Okay. Updike is very much a novelist of our times. He writes about the middle class and was married by, or officiated, his marriage, his latest marriage was officiated by a campus pastor on the East Coast, a Lutheran campus pastor on the East Coast. So he himself was a one-time almost seminarian. And one of his great short stories that I remember is called Lifeguard. And it's a short story of about 6 pages, and he's sitting on a lifeguard stand watching girls on this beach. Meanwhile, he does this theological thing about Kierkegaard and all these theologians he's been reading, and it's one continual stream of consciousness for 6 pages. And it's wonderful, this mixture of theology and lust and Kierkegaardian insight, and it's just a delightful unraveling of his soul in that particular short story. This novel, The Witches of Eastwick, has to do with, I believe, 4 witches who live in a community in the early 1980s, somewhere on the East Coast, I think Massachusetts. And this is simply a quote from the later chapters, and it's about dreams, and it's written like only an Updike could write. So we'll open initially with this piece by Updike, and then we'll do something more reverential in a moment. Kathy's going to read for us.
We all dream, and we all stand aghast at the mouth of the caves of our deaths, and this is our way in. Into the netherworld. Before plumbing in the old outhouses in winter, the accreted shit of the family would mount up in a spiky frozen stalagmite, and such phenomena help us to believe that there is more to life than the airbrushed ads at the front of magazines. The platonic forms of perfume bottles and nylon nightgowns and Rolls-Royce fenders. It is in the passageways of our dreams we meet, more than we know, one white lamplit face astonished by another.
John Updike, it is in the passageways of our dreams that we meet, more than we know, one lamplit face astonished by another. Well, let us bless our time, and I'd like to retrieve from my own tradition and passed in the church a little song that was sung at the Bible camp that I frequented when I was a young person, and it's called I'm going to ask for that Jill journal back. Mm-hmm. Have thine own way, Lord. Do you know it, some of you? I'll say the words. I'll sing it once, and then I think I'd like to ask that we sing it. We sing it together. Pull this battery out here. Got a hole in my pants that keeps slipping down my leg here. Okay, here we go. Have thine own way, Lord. Have thine own way. Thou art the potter. I am the clay. Mold me and make me after thy will. While I am waiting, quiet and still. You can harmonize if you wish. Have thine own way, Lord, have thine own way. Thou art the potter, I am the clay. Mold me and make me after thy will, while I am waiting, quiet and still. That little hymn I sang hundreds of times, but it never took any power, real power for me, until in my own personal experience, I moved down into this world. And when we talk about God molding us and shaping us, in this still, small, quiet, when I'm quiet, it's still. We're talking again about a power that comes from a deeper source of our being than we frequently acknowledge. And again, it refers, I believe, to the spiritual or unconscious world, which we are very much a part. This morning we're going to talk about types of dreams, and then, as I mentioned, some methods of dream interpretation. But would like to maybe just make a couple of comments on our closing discussion yesterday regarding the masculine and feminine. John and I had a chance to talk a little bit this morning on the grass about it. But I would like to give you an example of two dreams, one which happened to a man who happened to be a physician, a friend of mine, and the other to a young woman I was working with who was pregnant, that illustrate how the magnus opus, or this move toward wholeness, is reflected in the dream that we carry within us. The first one has to do with a young woman who was a member of a parish that I was affiliated with in Oregon, and she, initially the presenting problem was that she was having a lot of difficulty with her pregnancy. A lot of sickness, a lot of physical discomfort, and you could almost feel that there was something in the course of what was happening that was hinting that she just did not want to be pregnant. It was kind of a rejection of what was happening. She's fighting it a lot. And she came to me, and we talked for a couple of times together, and she shared with me that she had grown up on a farm in the Midwest with six brothers, and was a real tomboy. And when she went away to college, she tried to get into a sorority, and she was voted out. They would not let her in. Very self-conscious about her femininity as a woman. And married a very effeminate man, in a sense, I respect. She was very much a tomboy. Well, in any case, she became pregnant and had this pregnancy occur, and she came to me in about the fourth month of pregnancy with a dream, and the dream very simply was this, that she was very embarrassed about it. As we've learned these last few days, we frequently are, about our dreams. She was being seduced by an elegant French prostitute, by another woman in the dream. She was being made love to by this elegant French prostitute. She had no idea what, this weird image may have been. Well, we talked for a period of weeks together, and a couple of months later, she began to accept and delight in her pregnancy. One of the things she did was start to go to Lamaze classes, where she could identify with other pregnant women. And she quit work, she didn't quit work in itself, but she withdrew from a lot of activities that she had been normally involved in. It kept her very busy. So she was able to just to kind of delight in her physical condition, in a sense. It was time for walks and time to more of a relaxed kind of lifestyle. And what was happening, one could say, was that she was meeting her feminine. And her feminine was slowly becoming integrated with her. As it turned out, the birth of her child that spring was a little girl. And I was involved in the baptism of that child. The other example of, again, this problem of integrating the masculine and the feminine in these different archetypes. A physician once came to me with a dream who, we had a mutual friend who was an eccentric, an outdoors person. And he was very much, although he was 49 or 50, he was very much the boy. He's playful. He worked seasonally. Never kept a job more than a year. And he had a PhD in oceanography. The guy was quite competent. He just was a climber and a sailor. And my friend, the physician, was very much the controlled, conservative, appropriate, nice guy. I mean, when they chose for the Passion or the Christmas Story in our parish, Mary and Joseph, they chose that family to play those parts. And he had a dream in which he dreamed of this eccentric, our common acquaintance, was in a mental institution, a psychiatric ward. And my friend dreamed, the physician, that although he was diagnosed as being ill, he knew that he was really not ill. And so he wrote a fake subscription or prescription, and he faked the diagnosis so that one day, not now, but one day, the eccentric fellow would be released from the hospital. The last image in the dream series was of himself as a very old man riding a bicycle just in the sun. What we talked a bit about it, and basically what had happened here was he was a very responsible person, both as a warrior and as a father. He was, you know, he achieved in his own field of expertise. He achieved many honors. He was also very responsible on the church council, you know, all those things that responsible people do. And he had lost this. He had lost this boy, this playful part of himself. And so in the dream came to him. And we talked about it, and I felt personally that the dream held real promise for him, especially as he grew older. That this part of him, the boy, might emerge, maybe about to emerge. And last February 17th, and this dream was shared with me about 4 years ago. And he and I have kept in contact, but I since have left for Seattle. We were together on a boat in Lake Washington on my wife's birthday. And he led 25 people in a sailor song from Norway. Now, if you would have known him 4 or 5 years ago, that would have just been incredulous that he would do a thing like that, kind of a drinking song. And afterwards, I went up to him and I said, "Remember the dream, Carl?" He laughed at me. He said, "I remember the dream." That somehow the dream, there was a promise there that perhaps there was going to be a part of himself that was going to be reclaimed. Again, these parts of ourselves, the mother, the girl, the Amazon, the poet, the mystic, both in the woman and in a man, they emerge in different kinds of figures in our dreams to help us and to integrate with us. Both, all of these can have negative or positive dimensions to them. My mother died in 1973, and I had a series of dreams since then that have been very ominous about her. And she's really carried, I'm starting to integrate that now, a real negative, fearful part of the feminine. And I don't want to say too much about that, except that I've had problems relating to women, okay? And I believe that that has something to do with my relationship with my own mother, which anybody who's basically trained in any kind of psychological work know that the primary figures in our life are our mothers and fathers, and those are really formative influences on us. I had a lot of unfinished business about that, and so when she appeared to me, she appeared as very much of an ominous figure for me. So, in any case, the women I dreamed about, for instance, were prostitutes and seductive figures, and they weren't healthy feminine images. They were not healthy. The integration of the masculine and feminine. We could spend an easy hour on this. It could be a lot of fun, but I think I'll move on unless there's a question or two about it. Okay, let's go on with types of dreams. Lawrence Vanderpost, a colleague of Jung's, knighted by the King of England, or Queen of England, an explorer, a wonderfully elegant, sophisticated man of letters who still is alive in London, lives in England, wrote a book called The Mantis Carol. Have any of you heard of it? It's not printed here in the United States. It's printed by a London publishing company. It's about a dream that brought together himself and a woman in New York City. And in the book, he talks about his experience with the Bushmen of the Kalahari and who he had lived with for many years. And the dream is about a Kalahari Bushman who moved to New York via a nightclub in Havana where a wealthy New York patron saw him dancing. Brought him to New York, put him in the circus, and let him work as a butler. When this Kalahari Bushman died in old age, there was an encounter between him and the daughter that was raised by this wealthy patron. And so you see, she grew up, and in her household was this Kalahari Bushman who worked as a butler, tremendous dancer. And it is a wonderful, wonderful, magical, mystical story about the relationship of this young woman, it's a true story, and this butler, this Bushman who lived in the family. But in the book, Vanderpost goes on to say that the Bushman, and this was one of the reminiscences he makes in order for the dream to have made and make sense for the woman who he had met with there in New York. He said that the Bushmen have two different kinds of dances that they dance. One is what he calls the little dance, and one is the big dance. Now the little dance is when they dance, their heads are down to the ground, and they do very exquisite maneuvers and footsteps and whatever, but the head is pointed down. And there's another dance, and that's called the great dance, and that is when the arms are lifted high and you dance such as this. The story that Vanderpost unravels is that in fact, through the butler's life, when he would be asked to dance, he would always dance the little dance, and he was excellent at it. But right before he died, he turned to the girl, who was then about 16, and asked her from his bed to dance for him. And she started to dance, but he said no. And he tried to teach her, and she had never seen what he was trying to help her do, but basically he was asking her to dance the great dance for him. Now what this has to do with types of dreams is we have dreams that have to do with a little dance, and we have dreams that have to do with the great dance. The little dance has to do with ego's relationship with the world. The ego tasks. Making a living. Getting a union card. Essentially. Finishing school. Learning a trade. Learning manners. One of the great tasks I have with my confirmation students is that I'm helping out with is learning just civility. You know? How to stand up when an adult comes in the room. I mean, they don't know how to do that. How to say thank you. How to look somebody in the eye. And somebody's got to teach them those kinds of dances. Because they're important to our survival with each other. So the little dances are very important. But the big dance has to do with the spiritual and deeper questions and meaning and destiny of our lives. Two kinds of dreams. You see the same thing in the dream world. The first kind of dream that I'll put here is called the reactive dreams. These are what sometimes have been referred to as the bread and butter dreams. And these have to do primarily with compensatory reactions to daytime activities. They come and they go. They usually balance off the day somehow. They're like a teeter-totter. They bring you into balance. They work in a compensatory fashion between the ego and the self. Reactive dreams. They come and they go. Little dreams. I would say the great proportion of our dreams, this is the function that they would serve from an analytical point of view. They balance the psyche. And they can be helpful because they can give you insight into your experience. You can identify these dreams when you wake up and you know they're not important. I had a woman come to me last night and she said, well, I was going to come to you with a dream that I've been having or that I've carried around with me for a couple of years, but you know, when I sat down, I decided to tell you another one because I knew that was more important. See, you know if they're bread and butter dreams or not. They kind of just, they're there. They come and they go. The second series have to do with dreams from the preconscious. And these have to do with complexes. Complexes are constellations of your personality or psyche that are not in harmony. And they are what we call life issues. For instance, dealing with authority. Here's one. Dealing with your sense of autonomy. Here's another one. Dealing with your animalness, your creatureliness, your earthiness, your more, you know, those are complexes, and they are with us most of our life. You can usually spot these kinds of dreams because they're recurrent. They come back over and over again. They come back over and over again. And that's when you run into a recurrent dream, if you want to just look into your own dream world a little bit, that's a good clue right away that you're touching something important when you run into a recurrent dream or a pattern or a theme. Something important is happening. They may not be resolved ever, but even then it's good because it seems to me it's a reminder that God's never finished with us. At least on this side of reality, he's never finished. So the recurrent dream is sometimes they resolve themselves. Sometimes they can resolve themselves. Other times they can get unlocked by talking to someone, but oftentimes they will hang with you for long periods of time. Three. The third kind of dream now, I'm going to start to move into the big dance, has to do with what Native people call the big dream. This is what the early church fathers and native leaders and persons go and they look for when they fast. When I had to move to Seattle, I went to Michigan and stayed in our cabin to look for a big dream. Remember? I told you that a couple days ago. I never did get one. But and sometimes you go to the mountain, you know, and sometimes you don't get what you want. I'm sure that happened to Jesus many times. Lord, you know, now God, what Father, now what do I do? I'll bet you a lot of times it was silence for him as well. But the big dream comes. Sometimes you don't look for it and it can come. It can just bust and burst in. And it has to do, the big dream, either with a turning point in your own life, or you can actually dream for a people or for another person. Those are always tricky, whether or not, you know, if you dream about another person, you go up and say, I had a dream about you. Chances are it's really about yourself. But you need, there's certain ways you can test that, and sometimes it could be really a powerful and a big dream. There's a word for it. We call it, or Jung used to call it, the numinous dream. The spiritual, holy dream, power dream. Now, where does this come from? Looking over on our schematic there, I mean, where in this diagram would a dream like that come from? Because it looks like a closed system. I had somebody ask me from the Maverick team, well, where does God fit into this? I mean, is God the self? And what is all that about? Well, Jung had another understanding of the psyche that he developed that got him into incredible problems with Freud. And he basically felt that this was open at the bottom. And there was what he called, he had a fancy word for it, he called it the collective unconscious. But another more perhaps practical way of looking at it is that your spiritual world, your inner world, is somehow connected. Not only to other people's spiritual world, but to some vast, deep mystery that goes and passes almost beyond, not only in the past, but goes on beyond in the sense of kind of a future or future destiny. So this is very mystical stuff. And you can understand why it was so controversial. Now, as Christians, if I'm talking to a group like this, it would be different than if I were talking to a psychiatric staff, for instance. Right away, red flags would go up around the room for potentially appropriate reasons. This is the wild card. The wild card in dream work. That dreams don't necessarily have to always be about you. That in fact there can be a dimension in dreams that come from what we as Christians understand to be, or Morton Kelsey calls, the divine lover. So the big dream. Those are the dreams you read about. Jacob, Joseph, Daniel. Those people all had reactive dreams. But what you read about in Scripture is the distillation of the dream. You don't really, oftentimes you read, like in Joseph's dream, about his interpretation of dream. You don't really know if that was the dream. In other words, it might have been more complex and more baffling. It might have taken him time to figure it out, and then you read, you know, what was passed down by oral tradition. Chances are the dream was not readily apparent, just like it's not for us. So the big dream. There's two more areas here that I'll touch on. One is what I call the telepathic dream, where there is some kind of a communication between persons. Now this again is getting into what I call border country, and spiritual country, which needs to be handled carefully, but also with a certain amount of sacredness. This is why, for instance, among Native peoples, you don't use cameras or photographs when you talk about spiritual things. You don't use tape recorders. They are forbidden on the Hopi reservation. Any sketch pads, tape recorders, or photographs are not permitted to be taken on the Hopi reservation. There's a sense that there's something sacred going on, and you just there's a violation to somehow record that. In contrast, I remember one of my most devastating experiences I've had in my life was at the Lutheran School of Theology during the Malta Ethnic Caucus meeting, in which they had this grand communion of Asians, Native Americans, Blacks, and Hispanics. And this was to be a great kind of precursor to the new church. And for the communion service, there was a guy with a video camera running around right up as they were breaking the Eucharist with a little tie on, a white shirt, he was filming everything. I thought, you know, what is happening? How can they allow this to be happening in this seminary? So because something sacred is. Telepathic dream. I'll give you an example of one of those in a moment. But the last one is what we call telepathic dream. Hang on here. Yes, very rare, but can happen, predictive dream. Now, if most analysts only use an understanding of the dream as being that of the little dance, then the danger with that is you take the ego, and you even take this world, and what have you done with it? You've made it submissive, even to the ego. I mean, that is to me would be the quintessence, you know, of egocentricity, where you deny the possibility that even the dream world is only a reflection of your own ego's problems. But that is the position of you know, many analysts. Everything can be reduced to your own problems, your own stuff. So, types of dreams, I'll give you one example of a dream that was shared with me and by a friend of mine in Wisconsin who works for Lutheran Social Services. He said a woman came to him following the death of her 6-year-old boy who was hit by a bus after school and killed. That night she had a dream in which her father, the boy's grandfather, was in a rocking chair in a field, and the boy ran into his lap to be with him through the field of grass. Well, she carried that dream for a couple of weeks, and about a month later, the grandfather who lived in Florida, who had come up for the funeral, said to her, "There's been something I wanted to tell you ever since my grandson died, but I've been embarrassed about it, and I'm going to tell you. The night that he died, I had a dream. I was in a rocking chair. And he ran across the grass into my lap, to the meadow." Coincidence, huh? Or hallucination, or projection, possibly. Or is it perhaps a window into a reality that, in fact, carries us all? That remains unanswered, but I simply report to you what was reported to me. Um, Let's stop there and just let's respond to that. Any questions regarding the types of dreams? My basic response about dreams is that most of them are this, and possibly this. The vast majority, and that's my premise that I work with, people, encourage them to work with.
Yeah, oftentimes throughout my life, I've been in a situation where I thought, I know I dreamt this before, you know, and I can't think of any particular offhand, but I had a strong feeling that this had been a dream before.
It's called deja vu experience.
Deja vu.
It's a psychic phenomenon that's very common in human experience. I don't know a lot about that. Perhaps somebody here does. I know there's been some research done on it, but it's very, you know, it's hard to verify. I mean, you've got so little hard data to work with that it's hard to draw conclusions. But if in fact the deja vu experience is a real one, in one respect, it would certainly predict the power of dreams penetrating some kind of tapestry that carries us. That we're just not set afloat, that somehow there is something, some pattern weave that we ride on, we are carried by us. Richard.
So what I read about deja vu is that it's, a dream is a very, very general, nebulous, non-specific kind of dream, almost like a standard paragraph with the specific blanks left.
Okay.
And then later when your experience happens, you fill in the specific things in that experience and then read it back into the dream, making that specific
okay.
and saying this is what it was.
All right.
But in fact, the dream wasn't that really that way.
Okay.
But it's close enough so that now you generalize and go back and fill in the blanks.
Right.
And then you tell yourself, I've done this before.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact, maybe the dream wasn't really that, but real close enough so for you to do that.
Okay. I want to say something about children and dreams, but Bob, and let's go with you two first. Yeah.
I was just going to ask you, is it healthy or helpful to, after you've had a dream, to look at these categories and categorize them?
I will go over, I've got three specific tools to give you, and one of them will answer that question
okay,
in a moment.
Okay, so a friend that's up here with me, we had a really interesting experience this morning when we met in the bathroom. We had dreamt a similar dream last night.
Oh, okay.
And we dreamt that our pastor back home had died, and he is currently undergoing a kidney transplant, and our reaction to that was, it's a coincidence. You know, we miss home and we're thinking about
okay.
it. Rather than, well, let's hurry up and try and communicate you know,
right.
something to find out if he's okay. And
both of you had the dream. If I were you, I would try to find out what happened last night. And just on one level, I would. The fact the two of you had the same dream, on one level it would be, you know, conceptions, ideas that hold in, maybe what he represented is dying, whatever it could be. But that since both of you had the same dream, and he is physically undergoing very much of a critical kind of passage right now, I would definitely honor that somehow. Either when you get out of the village or maybe send a message out or just to find out. Bob, you're going to say something?
No, I was just going to ask you, people that have done sleep lab work and stuff, do big dreams and little dreams correlate at all with quality of sleep, preferring sleep, sleep?
It's real interesting.
So,
manipulate. I can't answer that. I don't know. I think you need to know that the big dream comes rarely. It comes rarely. And so I'm not sure if one would occur in the sleep lab, for instance, if it would just be measured with a greater intensity. You know the big dream when you feel it. You know that you're not going to forget it. it is a turning point in you, and you carry. You may not understand it, but it carries you. It carries you. Let me say something about children and dreams, because I know we have some parents here. The way you work with children and dreams is much different than how you work with adults, because the tasks of the ego are different. The tasks of the ego when you're young is to build the ego. And as you get older, then it's a question of integrating the ego with the self. First of all, there is some common ground. One is to acknowledge that the dream world is real with children, and to affirm it, and to listen to their dreams. Not to say, it's only a dream. But just say, wonderful, can you tell me about the dream? And allow children to share both the negative and positive dreams with you. Don't say much about them. Sometimes I'll have them draw a picture of their dream, if it bothers them or whatever. Or if they have a good dream, we celebrate it. When you have a series of nightmares with a child that are terrifying with dreams and nightmares, what you want to do there is to build the ego by entering the dream with the child. And you can do this very simply by saying, close your eyes. Now, look at the witch. You see her? And trembling, yeah. And you see, now, there's an angel by your side. Or Jesus, you can use Jesus or an angel. You see the angel? Yeah. But the angel or Jesus has a big sword. See the sword? Cut off her head. You did it? Yeah. How do you feel? Okay. You give a hug? It's going to be okay. Just Jesus is with you. The angel is with you to protect you. It's a way to know for a child's psyche that they're not going to be overwhelmed with their unconscious, which is always a threat in a child. So you have to build the ego and help the child, usually through some kind of guided imagery, conquer the dream. Now with an adult, you use a different kind of integration or technique, and that's what we'll look at now in terms of three different ways. I've got a handout for you today too, before you leave. So. A couple of pages of tips and suggestions. Okay, let's look at three different ways to look at the dream. One is keeping a dream journal, and this basically is periodically recording your dreams, not all the time because it's very hard work and draining for you, but periodically learning how to listen to that. I have about 2 dream journals in my 7 years, and what I've done after many months of dreaming, I've looked back and see if I've seen themes, and I've underlined them, and I've got several underlined, and I'll just read you an example of the themes that you know, I have used, or I've been able to identify, that have been part of my own dream life. Moving too fast. Dog needs care. My dog. And there's a direct correlation to my dog and my own physical self. You know, my creatureliness. Need to remember the consequences of my actions. I'm continually kind of going down, which has to do, I believe, here with I'm a very idealistic person. And as I grow older, there's a process as I get wiser, if that's what I'm happening to me, where I'm coming down. I'm on the edge of the church. I can't get in, but the church itself is ill, and then I've got robes, my robes are faded, historic, you know, those were uplifting dreams for me. Bit by a huge feminine bear, she can kill, I've written, big exclamation point. The feminine can kill. How can the feminine kill? John and I were talking about this. The feminine is wonderful. It's sensitive, it's open, it's nurturing, it's, right? That's one side of the feminine. The other side is gooey, obsessive, smothering, seductive. The rate of divorce among pastoral counselors is real high because they move into the feminine world, which is sensitivity, compassion, listening, and you get tricked. You don't know when the hour's up. You're with a pretty girl, and you say, well, let's talk 15 more minutes. So the feminine and the masculine there is always, yeah. Okay, second way. In other words, here, it's not so much doing anything with the dream except just listening to it, honoring it. And as you honor it, you'll get more accustomed to the world. And then after a period of time, you can look back and look for themes. Secondly, there is what I'm going to call, it's got a 3-4 letters here, T-T-A-Q. When you have a dream, what you do is you first of all give it a title, try to pick out a theme in the dream. You know, there might be more than one, but you pick out a theme. And then this word comes from clinical work. It's called affect. It means monitor or recognize the emotion you had during the dream. That's one of the first clues about the dream. And if those of you who have talked to me about dreams here, you know the first thing I ask you is, how do you feel about it? First thing I ask you. Because the affect, your emotion, always is a hint about if the dream is trying to help you or reinforce you or warn you. It's a clue right away. No matter what the image may be, you can have a dream image is full of blood and violence, but you may feel great. So that's a clue that something is happening, conflict and whatever within you, but it is something wonderful is going on. Title, theme, affect, and then finally cue. You look at the dream and have the dream ask you a question. See if the dream, you can put the dream into a question that is posed to you. Okay? That's the second technique. You can work with an individual dream. I've been knocking the feminine here a little bit. But let me knock the masculine a little bit. I'm going to pop up here for a second. This Amazon archetype of the feminine, which is now becoming increasingly popular in the culture, which is, I'm Kathy Rigby, and if I use tampons, I don't have a period. See, I can do anything. I can do anything a man can do. I don't have to recognize that I have a period. I menstruate. A denial of the feminine. And in the ancient sculptural stones they have found in South America, Central South America, the Amazons that they had discovered, the stone figures have one breast removed. So that when the Amazon pulls back her bull, the breast does not get in the way. The price that the new feminism pays for buying into a masculine model is self-mutilation of their own nurturing self. And those of you who know, I mean, I always ask, can you imagine, what's her name that runs the Eagle Forum? What's her name?
Phyllis Schlafly.
Phyllis Schlafly, or who is editor of...
Of Stein.
Can you imagine either one of them giving birth to a baby? I mean, try to image that for a minute. From their public or their personas. They're both pretty tough ladies. Now, they represent different sides of basically the same coin, but my point there is that there is a price to pay. And I talked with a couple of you last night who are in the medical world and have borne witness in your practice to the price women are increasingly paying for buying in to a very competitive, aggressive, out-of-balance world of the male patriarchal society. So the feminine works too here, and works for balance. Let's look at the last one here, through three.
John?
Yes,
please. I thought you were knocking the masculine. That sounded to me like you're knocking the feminine again.
Okay. I might have been doing that unconsciously. Help me. I was saying that men in my generation tend to lift up the feminine. See, they say, you got to get sensitive. Women want you to be sensitive. They want you to be caring. They want you to be a good parent. Non-competitive games. See? There's truth in part to that. But that's very much the feminine call, which is truth, but it's not the whole truth. The world also needs the masculine. And what I was saying here is that many women look to the women's movement as a potential looking for paradigms, looking for models, role models. And I'm saying that I'm not sure that they're going to necessarily find that which is whole, fully whole yet. And that's what's so dangerous about looking outside of yourself. You have to test whatever you meet in life and encounter, including me and other people at Holden Village, with your own inner experience. This is why this dream stuff is so threatening to the church or to clergy. It takes away their power. It's saying that our people have power, have a kingdom within them. And it means that we do less of this and more of talking to each other about what happened last night when you were in the bathroom talking with your friend this morning. You know, more of our sharing of our experiences. So, I took a kind of tangent. But the masculine and feminine, I mean, for young people, this is a tough one, for young adults. You know, when you're dating a girl, what are you supposed to do? Reach over and give her a kiss? And kind of bust through her space to do that? Or you wait to say, I give you permission now to give me a kiss? There's a wonderful cartoon I saw in Harper's. It showed a woman and a man at a doorway, and she said, Charles, it's been a wonderful evening. You've been compassionate and sensitive. It's too bad you're such a wimp. So, you know, women have their own jokes and things, and men have their own jokes, and there is this attempt to find balance. My wife always loves to go look at the animals. She loves to go look at the animals. Loves the zoo.
Bless her.
She loves the zoo. She says, you know, we got all these highfalutin things about we are spiritual beings, but we're also animals. And that is what this world teaches us if we get out of balance. You used to have had a wonderful insight that was quoted once by Tournier. Wonderful insight. He said, people who come to me with sexual problems usually have a spiritual problem. And people who come to me with spiritual problems usually have a sexual problem. Now, what did he mean by that? Do you think? In the broadest categories. Somebody try that.
The mind and body and spirit all connected.
That's right. People who want more Bible study, they want more and more Bible study, see? Sometimes those folks are Bible study junkies. They need to get out and dance over there at the Village Center. That'd be the best thing that could happen to them. Affirming their body, that's what Jung meant by sexuality. He meant their body, their biological body. Earthiness. And at the same time, people who are promiscuous, you know, you're out of either your own experience or your friends, people who are promiscuous and are into multiple partners and things, there is a denial of their spiritual self, which has to do with commitment See, we're partly animals, but we're not wholly animals. And there's a denial of the spiritual part of ourselves. So there's that weird reversal when people come to us with problems. The spiritual needs to become more earthy, the earthy needs to become more spiritual. One last piece here in terms of a hint, how to work with dreams. Here's one. I've not used this yet, but I just discovered it when I was up here doing some reading, and we'll no doubt use it. You draw four quadrants. Well, there it is, all right? Okay. And you divide your dream. Well, I'll call this using quadrants. You divide your dream into three parts, like three acts in a play. And you do one act here, and then when you get them all written down, you can draw symbols. You don't have to write with words, you can draw symbols. You finish the fourth one with, you just close your eyes and you finish it. You finish the dream. You finish it. Then the fourth. Then you look at it. In other words, you complete the dream in the waking state. And then you look back and see what kind of connections you've made to see if anything has happened. Okay. I've got plenty of other suggestions here that are on this handout, and I will pass these around now. Practical tips on what you can do when you dream. Last question here is about 1:45. Comment, question? Yeah.
Yes, women were talking this morning, and some men were hanging around too, and we were talking, and it sounded like women actually dream more than men. What would your comment be of that?
Are they just more aware of it?
In this culture, the feminine carries the spiritual. If you go down to the Amazon, Central America, the males carry the feminine. They're the ones who have the secret societies. They're the ones who carry the rituals on. They're the ones who have the dreams. In this culture, we were talking again medically, a couple folks in the medical community, women seem to be more willing to deal with what they feel in this culture down here, more willing to explore this. And I have my own theory on that, and I'm sure those of you who have read feminist theologians have too. Women have been the repressed and suppressed people in this culture. They have been the victims in this culture. And where do you go when you don't have a kingdom in the world? Where do you go? You go in. And now women, wanting power in the outer world, there's going to be a price. You know that old Jewish proverb, take from God what you want, but pay for it. You're going to see possibly, and maybe it's healthy, that all of a sudden there might be some kind of a slow transition or reversal that happens about who carries the feminine spiritual in the society. I believe it's suppressed and repressed people. That's one of the secrets of the New Testament and Old Testament. It's those which don't have a kingdom here that look down deep inside. See, when Jesus said, you have to love your enemy, I used to think that meant you should just go and love your enemy. I didn't think that there was any gift that you received from loving your enemy. If you look at this, enemy being a projection, you need to love the enemy, your enemy, because your enemy is bringing part of yourself back to you. That's why you need to love your enemy. You have to lose your life to gain it. Last insight there. Do you remember that one? I used to think up until I was through seminary, confession time, I had to go down and die somewhere as a missionary. I mean, I wouldn't publicly admit that to you, but that's what I secretly believe. look at this from a spiritual point of view. Lose yourself. You have to die in order to find yourself. That's what Jesus says. You have to lose your life to find it. What is he talking about? From a point of view of analytical work here.
You need to let go of your ego.
You need to die here so that this might be born anew. We're talking humbleness. We're talking community. We're talking authority. Being willing to give that up. Be a servant.
It involves listening.
Listening.
Being a good listener.
Being a good listener.
Giving.
Absolutely, John. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm not a Native American, as you refer to the Amazon. What have you found in certain Native Americans, yeah, part of the women?
Well, interestingly enough, this varies with tribes, but in the Northwest, I know three tribal chairmen, they're all women. Tribal chairmen, they were some of the toughest women and wisest women I have ever met have been tribal leaders. And to show you the kind of power they have by being in touch with this, they know how to fight too, you know, but they have this power. Catherine Harrison, tribal chairman of the Grand Round Indian people in Oregon, doesn't own a phone. Does not own a phone. She's in Washington, D.C., you know, cavorting with congressmen three times a year. She does not own a phone, Leah. What kind of reality does she live in? I couldn't live 2 days without a phone in Seattle. I mean, I can't even perceive what that world would be like.
You're doing it this week.
Yeah, it's not bad, see? So, the Indian community, more about that next week. Some of you, most of you won't be here, but it is a very complex and sad and very confused and complex community. And one of the things that we do, including myself, is to project into Indians. So, Jung used to say the Indian people carry the soul of this society, and they carry it as a projection. Everybody who hangs out with Indians wants to be one for a while. Then after a while, you reject that. But to show you the power of the projection, you know Ken Kesey, the novelist out of Oregon, he wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Do you remember Chief Broom in the novel? Mm-hmm. Chief Broom was this incredible character, and I talked to the head, the assistant associate professor at the University of Montana, a white guy, who said to me that that depiction in Kesey's novel is the best depiction of the Indian psyche that he has ever seen.